Welcome to the CNS Podcast featuring Dr. Daryl Inaba, Research Director for CNS Productions.
Hi, and welcome once again to the CNS Addiction Podcast. I'm Howard Lemaire here with Dr. Daryl Inaba to talk about addiction recovery research and things that are related. We're going to talk a lot about treatments, different aspects of treatment today. And also, there's some news about the gambling center in the brain. But some highlights of related things. There's a story in USA Today, Gaping Hole in Addiction Treatment. Of course, that's a good treatment. So we're going to talk about those two things, a few elements involved and some other things. There's a story in USA Today, Despite Obamacare, Gaping Hole in Addiction Treatment. And this story has to do with a dated federal law limiting the number of beds to a small number in alcohol and drug treatment facilities. And also several primary care doctors have gathered to learn about addiction at Hazelden's Betty Ford Center in Naples, Florida. So that's interesting because we keep talking about the need for primary care doctors to have more understanding of addiction. And another story that's kind of about treatment is Uruguay using marijuana medically, since they've legalized it, to treat prisoners in prison who are addicted to cocaine or cocaine paste. But the major story here that got us thinking about treatment was a multi-part series on NBC looking at the various elements of addiction and treatment. And one of them was How to Fix Rehab, an expert who lost a son to addiction who now has a plan. Well, let's just launch it and talk about it, Daryl.
Yeah, you know, the article that you're citing about How to Fix Rehab was actually just jotting down the statements made by Tom McLellan, who is one of the real heroes. He's one of my heroes and one of my idols in addiction and addiction treatment. He's done more research to normalize or help addicts understand that they aren't demons, and society to understand they have a true medical illness. He's the guy that showed that, you know, that treating addicts has the same amount of relapse tendency as treating any kind of chronic compulsive disorder like hypertension, asthma, or diabetes, and yet addicts get vilified when they have relapse. He also showed that the outcomes right now, the positive long-term outcomes we're getting from treating addicts stand in a fair comparison to the good outcomes we get in treating diabetics and asthmatics. So it's really a great thing he's been doing. And this call he has to finally start to normalize treatment and fix treatment is nothing new to me, but I think he's correct in that for the rest of the world, or rest of America anyway, we've been not really open to treatment of addiction and moving forward into this new field. Maybe that's why a lot of people are asking me to come and speak on the new medical developments in treatment and why the Affordable Care Act making addiction a true medical illness and calling for more primary care, more medical care, but hasn't had the resounding success that it should have in terms of getting more and more addicts into recovery and having more and more positive outcomes.
Well, but there still isn't the capacity, though, is there?
Yeah, that's the other factor, and I'm right in the mix of that here in the programs I work with in Oregon, in that there was a prediction that there was going to be a need for 45% increase in treatment capacity. You're going to have more counselors, more staff, more support staff, more resources, and more space. Basically, just more counseling rooms and more intake rooms and group rooms and stuff to meet the needs of the people who are going to be signed up for care under the Affordable Care Act, which mandates that addiction is a true biological disorder and that addicts deserve as much treatment or the same type of treatment you give any kind of chronic persistent disorder like asthma or diabetes. And what's happened is the exchanges and these insurance groups and medical groups that were supposed to be ready for this are ill-prepared. They're still kind of stumbling around trying to take care of all the medical changes that are coming about, and addiction is low on their priority. So that's part of it. The other part of it is there were some treatment programs that I heard of that when this news was out there, they had enough reserves and they had working capital that they went ahead and hired staff and they went ahead and expanded programs and bought space to meet the increased needs, and they're doing well. But the programs I've been working with closely have been burnt so much by the state funding mechanisms, the county funding mechanism, and federal funding mechanisms that they can't afford to take that kind of risk. So they're doing the Missouri attitude is what I call it, the show me attitude. So they're looking at what's called a ramp up, where they want to see increases in numbers of patients who can get treatment, and that treatment could be paid for under Medicaid and Medi-Cal, Medicare, before they're going to expand. They want to put that money in the bank sort of before they're going to spend it out to expand. And in the meantime, the people working those programs are getting totally wigged out with so many treatment requests coming in. They're unable to handle it. People are put on longer waiting lists. People don't get into treatment. And I guess that should have been foreseen, but that's right. A reality. And that's part of why we don't have enough treatment, and the Affordable Care Act isn't really improving treatment the way it should have.
Well, that sounds like a catch-22, waiting for the people to show up before you build it. I mean, that's – no. If you're gonna play a baseball game in a big city for 50,000 people, you're going to have people show up in a $25,000 person stadium and then go, oops, because we made a mistake. We're going to have to turn away half of the crowd. Not logical.
Well, the other you're talking the field of dreams approach. The field of dreams approach is you build it and they will come. But the other approach,
right, exactly.
The other approach I'm talking about, of which I'm afraid I have to agree is logical based upon the history in this field, is that you respond is that show me. You know, you have an announcement or something. You have, you know, a 50% increase in patients in requests and treatment requests, and you respond immediately to that first month of that request, and you hire more people, and you rent out more space and everything, and then all of a sudden nobody shows up the second month or the third month or fourth one, and then you're stuck holding the bag and you're going broke. So
right.
So they're taking the Missouri approach, show me state. You know, show
right,
me
right.
That this is going to be a continuous thing before I'm going to invest in it.
But aren't there already a great percentage more people on the waiting list than are receiving treatment already?
Absolutely. And in that process – that waiting list was there before the Affordable Care Act came into being. We had so many people on the waiting list,
right.
Not because you know they weren't eligible for treatment or anything, but the fact is there wasn't any funding for it. Prior to Affordable Care Act, addiction was a carve-out thing in the insurance coverage system. Many insurance companies didn't cover it. And if they did cover it, they gave you 5 days of treatment when you know, you're talking a lifelong disease and you get 5 days of recovering for it. So there was a lack of funding for treatment, and so there was less treatment slots available for those who need it, and there still are, which results in huge waiting lists before, and they'll continue until we can sort of equalize things with what will be funded for treatment and what the capacity can be built by the treatment field. The other thing I didn't mention here is, you know, we didn't have the schools ramp up. We didn't have the medical schools really ramping up. We had, 15 universities in the first couple of years, and now maybe 20 universities that are actually teaching addiction medicine and doing graduate work in addiction medicine. We didn't have big expansions in community college or four-year colleges and universities on addiction therapy or addiction clinical work being an actual major, and that still hasn't happened. And so where are you going to get the staff to work in these places as you expand them?
Well, then, and there's also then the new policies or the new requirements being implemented, at least in some areas, requiring much more education than has traditionally been, where in pretty much up until currently, it's recovering people, recovering addicts, who become most of the counselors.
Well, that's one of the points that Tom McClellan makes in How to Fix Rehab, is that we have now the science. We know what the science of addiction is, and I still say now there should be a PhD level in providing clinical services for addicts, because it encompasses so many things, pharmacology and medicine, psychiatry, neurology, you know, biology. It's a huge input of information that people have to know now to do it. And one of his concerns is that the field has not kept pace with that. And we have lots of the old-fashioned, I did it, so you can too, without a very amateuristic approaches to treatment and recovery. And we really need a much more scientific approach with a lot of staff who have abilities in understanding mental illnesses, ability in staff who can understand the new evolving field of pharmacology and the treatment of addiction and what can work and what can hurt addicts, and a whole bunch of statistics and sociology and everything else that comes with it. And I agree with that. We don't have enough of that, and the schools aren't actually preparing their staff. Now, saying this, I was just at our local community college here and worked with one of the professors who are training students to get certification in this field. And he shocked me that it's sort of happening here, that, you know, his program wasn't expanded. He has the same class loads, although he has full enrollment, so they had to give him a bigger classroom anyway. And the other thing is that was quite amazing. He says every one of his students who graduated last year got jobs immediately, which means that the field is sort of starting to expand, but it's not expanding fast enough, and I agree it's not. Now, Tom McClellan talks about several things in his article, not just that they're, you know, we're behind, but I think the main thing he talks about is the basic model of treating addiction is an anachronism. It's stuck way back in the 1930s based upon not scientific work and not professional work, just upon very personal work.
Right, that's what we were talking about earlier. The way the AA people, the way that Wilson founded AA.
Yeah, Bill W. and Dr. Bob that founded it. One of the things that I continue to try and educate addicts about, as well as the general population, if they look at the history of AA, it's really has an important clue to where Tom McClellan is headed for, and I think we need to hear more. And that was when Bill W., who happened to be a chronic relapser, and that's important because so many addicts beat themselves up in relapse and thinking they're just the scum of the scum when they relapse. And we have to more realize that relapse is part of every chronic medical condition like diabetes and asthma. But he was a chronic relapser. And when he got sort of connected with a guy named Ebby T. with the Oxford group, and learned, went with this group that was a spiritually oriented, a self-realization group, an existentialist group who looked at themselves and needing to be happier and what how a person can grow in their own psychology. He embraced that, and he thought he had found the answer. He thought he found a way of finally maintaining his sobriety. And the thing he did is he immediately tried to proselytize that and go out and campaign for it and drag in every alcoholic he knew and every addict he knew into the Oxford group, because he was sure they would become recover, or they'll become clean and sober for a long term, like he felt he was beginning to accomplish. But what happened was, and all the many of the people he brought in to the Oxford group, very frustratingly, they almost all immediately relapsed, and he became so depressed himself out of this that he relapsed. And it was his last time at Towns Hospital in New York, where he was talking with his I guess what we would call his sponsor or mentor these days, Dr. William Silkworth, that Dr. Silkworth listened to him being so frustrated about what happened to him. So, you know, where you went wrong, Bill, where you went wrong is you went to the spiritual aspect. You went to the understanding yourself first, rather than putting the allergy first. Dr. Silkworth called it an allergy because he didn't want to be attacked by the medical institutions at the time calling it disease. But he says, you have to start with the science of it. You have to start with the biology of it. You have to start that this is something that is beyond your control. It's a biological process. That's alcoholism, not something of your spiritual loss or anything. And if you do that first and you accept that first, then you fix all of yourself by taking the shamanistic approach of both the physical and the spiritual part. And that's what finally worked with Bill W., and he took that approach to Bob S., and through them they got long-term recovery, and they started 12 steps. And I think that's what's missing now. I think Tom McClellan is right. We've jumped into with the old-fashioned way or taken too much of looking purely at a spiritual, although that's tremendously important, looking at fixing who you are before we can understand that you're basically powerless in terms of a biological condition and accepting the medical aspects of this disease first. And that's where I think Tom is heading, and I've been heading for a long time. I agree with him 100% that we need to change addiction treatment. I see where I differ from him is I see addiction changing, maybe a little faster than he does, but I really see it changing. He mentioned recovery programs for professionals like airline pilots and doctors, and that's something I always weave into my talks on the treatment of addiction. And in that talk, I always have to start off with a warning or with a, you know, a potential disclaimer in that when you're talking about these population of professionals, airline pilots, physicians, you know, people of stature, you also have to consider into it what we call recovery capital, that they have licenses, they have reputations to protect, they have more resources, financial, medical resources, and social resources to help them obtain their recovery goals a lot more than the majority of people who have this condition and who are struggling with this condition, who have very little resources to do that. But he cites these programs for pilots and doctors who have, you know, anywhere from 85 to 95% long-term recovery rates. And we have to remember that those people have a much higher recovery capital than the ordinary people. But saying that, there are about 10 things that I've identified that I think Tom McClellan also have identified, certainly Kevin McCauley has identified, that are different in these programs that make it prone to be much more successful than the regular programs we have for most people. One of them, they start off with residential treatment. They start off with isolating the addict, segregating them.
For a long period.
For 90-day minimum. 90-day minimum is not a long time. When we're talking about the brain and how long you've been an addict, we know it's going to take longer than that, but they say for at least a 90-day minimum, if not longer, at ARC, we can talk people into it. We like them in residential treatment for 90 days, but then going straight into a halfway living in situation, halfway house, where they're doing day treatment care for another 6 months, and then we're looking at a year. Because it takes that long before the brain even comes back to being able to function and help you maintain your recovery. But 90 days residential is a real luxury. I mean, people can't afford it. Insurance companies won't pay for it. The state are starting to pay for it, but they usually pay 30 days. And if you can start off with 90 days where you get, you know, detached from all your triggers, all your stresses, all the things that can make you use, it gives you your brain a good start in becoming clearer and becoming able to recover. And then there's immediate aftercare program. And after that 90 days, these programs have, you don't leave treatment. you continue in treatment, usually into a little bit lower level care, something like day treatment where you're doing, you know, half a week in terms of treatment services, and not going back to work yet, but concentrating on your need to get in recovery. Along with that is there is usually a sober living environment that you are transitioned to, meaning you don't go home yet, where you have all the triggers. You might have a using spouse, you might have using relatives or friends or even kids. You don't go back to your own neighborhoods and haunts. You go into a sober living where you're still going to be in a safe place and protected against using to, again, promote the best shot you can of not being triggered and being able to maintain sobriety. Unusual that he was sort of saying that the old 12 steps is not that effective. I think he claimed it was only about 10% effective, and something about a lot of people, they just don't connect to that. And that might be true, but also 12 steps have been some of the most successful programs, and at a minimum, it attaches people to a different environment in a social system of people who are likewise trying to maintain sobriety, which I think is extremely important to addicts. And a lot of programs that are successful usually mandate that you participate, especially while you're in residential. You do it every day. It's part of the program. You have to do a 12-step meeting, and they take you different 12-step meetings in the area. And then when you're in outpatient day treatment, intensive outpatient, they usually mandate that you go every day. Sometimes they actually make you keep a attendance card where people who are chairing those programs or secretaries programs, you have to get it signed off to make sure you're going, to make sure you are getting engaged in that process. Clients ask me, well, how long do I have to keep this card? You know, how long do I have to keep doing this? And I said, well, you keep having that card signed up until you want to do it. You want them to sign it, and then that'll be a good time to realize you're doing good. Then there's a automatic plan and a relapse prevention plan established, and I think that's real important, that if you do have a slip before it becomes a full-scale relapse, that there is a plan that you get right back into treatment immediately. It's not a disgrace. It's not a shameful situation. You're not yelled at, but you're welcome back, that you're addressing it right. You're coming right back into treatment, and you're reassessed, and we go through maybe another 90 days of residential treatment. What's interesting in these elements that I've identified for successful treatment, the programs with increased drug testing, even those programs with those annoying monitors on your wrist or ankle that lets a computer know that when you've actually drank again or when you've actually used again, you know, that's monitoring you 24/7, they're having better results and have much better results. One of the studies I read in a foreign country found that the best indicator of good outcome in treatment was the number of urine tests you did while you were in a treatment. Programs that had you do a lot more urine tests had a lot better outcomes than programs who didn't have a lot of urine testing. So that's a real thing. There is a addictionologist, and this is something that Tom is really pushing. And I'm pushing that this is becoming a primary care disorder. And the medications being developed to help addicts maintain recovery are just exploding. And that means that addicts have to be attached to both an addictionologist who is able to monitor and provide appropriate medications if it's needed, also monitor urine tests and monitor treatment very well. But I think a psychiatrist is important. I think there is a good number of co-occurring disorders or psychiatric problems, and it's best when we can provide psychiatric treatment right as part of the initial program rather than having to send somebody out to external psychiatric services where they can get their psychiatric medications and things in the program, and I think that's effective. One of the last things that I tend to always agree with that some people aren't sure is good outcome programs have what's called fun in recovery. They build right into the program weekly or biweekly activities that's going to promote addicts having an attachment to the great, you know, the great highs that your brain has to give you without you even doing drugs. And that's taking them to ball games, professional athletic events, taking them bowling, taking them out dancing, listening to music, and doing things sober that produces just a tremendous positive feeling in people's brain. And I think that's what you want to do in a positive program. You want to have people learn to have good feelings and funds without having to use drugs to do that, and that prevents relapse. I think those are my elements. I think they concur with a lot of Tom McClellan's element, and the basic thing is being able to switch this whole concept, take the stigma away from addiction, and make both addicts and the general society look at this condition as a diabetes, as an asthma, as hypertension. And the addicts have the responsibility then to monitor and treat and manage their condition to be the healthiest they can. And society has the need to accept addiction as a true biological medical disorder and not a moral issue that the old, unfortunately he's right, the old 12-step programs may even promote, and the old way of treating and confronting addicts may it promote. So I'm all for the changes he's advocating for.
Yeah, there are definite elements of 12-step that are dated and kind of run counterproductively. That's almost all the time we have, but I wanted to talk a little bit about this story. That was great, by the way. Thank you, Daryl. Basically, what that comes down to is there's a lot more detail, and there's a lot more time and energy spent in each different aspect of the treatment program. From the beginning, abstinence component, to the aftercare, to the living environment, to the relapse plan, and the other elements, testing and addictionologist. And I think fun is really important all the time. But I wanted to cover one other thing, and that's a new place in the brain that's been linked to gambling addiction, the insula. And do you know about this very much? I just read it briefly.
Howard, yeah, the insula really is part of the neocortex, a layer of brain cells that are a thin layer of brain cells that covers a wide surface just above the mesocortex or just above the primitive brain. And we know that low activity in that part of the brain is definitely linked to craving and relapse. The people who have low activity there have poor decision-making ability. It's linked to their craving reaction, and they're much more likely to relapse. And it's part of the five areas of the brain that have been identified that if are in low activity when people are getting out of program, it will signify they're going to relapse with 95% accuracy. I think this new study that you're talking about,
it is saying an overactive insula.
Well, the overactive insula, I have to look at that in closely, but they're talking about
in particular causing people to chase their losses, which we know is a major component of obsessive gambling.
Yeah, they're looking at gambling addiction, and this is at the University of Cambridge by Dr. Luke Clark. And what they're looking at is that area of the brain is maybe overactive in terms of a near miss or in terms of the gambling fallacy. The gambler who has a what we would call a
staying in the action.
Well, they have an entitlement. You have a strong sense of entitlement when you're a gambler. You played on this slot machine all night long. It's been a loser all night long. It's gonna win now, even though every pull is the same is the same odds.
Right.
It's good. You're due to win. You own this machine. Nobody come near it. You know you're gonna pay off. So you sit there and lose another $14,000 or something like that.
Right.
Or you know the even on a football game toss where they go out in the field and they say, well, it's come up heads the last 20 times in a row. And the fallacy is that it's going to have to come up tails sooner or later, so it's going to come up tails now. I'm entitled to a tail now, so you call tails, and it comes up heads because every toss is going to be 50-50, no matter how many times you throw it.
And we know coins always like heads better.
Well, in any event, the insula, maybe because it's overactive, feeds into that fallacy. It feeds into a much greater sense of entitlement. It feeds into the fact that you can beat the odds, or not the odds, but you have control over things that you really have no control over. And so in knowing this, the slot machines, the poker machines, and where you can play all those multiple lines and everything, they're all programmed to show you if you just put in another dime or bet another bet on it, you would have hit the bottom line. That would have been, you know, a $10,000 hit or something like that. They're programmed to have near misses, all the near misses that are showing. And if in with somebody with an overactive insula, they're saying that feeds into that entitlement more, and that they're bound to win sooner or later, and you go for it, and you become obsessive and compulsive with it. Whereas people with a normal active insula, it's not a big thing. So what, you know? Yeah, the line down there, if you put in a dollar more, it might have made you $50,000, but you did put in a dollar more, and it ain't going to show up there if you do. So that's I think, where the insula is showing. But, you know, we're finding more and more of these places in the brain and more activity. So I'm sure we're going to continue to rewrite the brain's addiction pathway and all the parts involved with the brain, not only in terms of initial action of being overactive or underactive, but that's the thing about addiction, is you're going to have some parts of the brain, like the go switch and dopamine, that are overactive for that first win or the first hit. And then as you continue to feed into your addiction, it depletes those areas, and then you become underactive in those areas, and then you crave to want to get back in the action. And so it's the relativity of that and what role it plays and at what time in your addiction that's going to play a role. But insula has always been a suspect area for addiction, of all addictions, not just gambling.
Yeah. Well, this is interesting new research. Anyway, that's all the time we have for this time. Thanks, Daryl, as ever. Thanks for listening. And we welcome your comments, questions, suggestions, as always, which you can do at the CNS website, cnsproductions.com. And there's places to leave a note, respond to the blog in the podcast there, or ask Daryl a question, or any number of places to make comments. Anyway, that's it for now. Join us again next time. Thanks, Daryl.
Hey, thank you, Howard.
That wraps our pod for today. Thanks for visiting the CNS Podcast. Please check back soon for the next in the series and visit our website, www.cnsproductions.com.